Hey everybody, welcome back to Redemption's Table. Here we are, the middle of March. I can't say A tu Brute, because the Ides of March were yesterday. And I can't say Top of the Morning to you, because St. Patrick's Day, well, that's not until tomorrow. But we did just hear the first part of another wonderful Sky Peterson song, Sandcastles, off her Searching for Us album. We will hear the remainder of that song at the end of today's episode, and I encourage you to check out all of Sky's wonderful music on whatever music platform you happen to listen. Folks, I am humble and excited. We've been talking about this table. I've been thinking about this table for almost a year now to bring to us today our special guest, Russ Ramsey. Russ, welcome to Redemption's Table.
It's great to be with you. Great to be with you.
You wrote a book, and it came out last year, and it's one of my favorite books of last year. Maybe my favorite. I think it is my favorite art book I have ever read. Just the name of the book is Rembrandt is in the Wind. Love the book. Love the title.
Thanks.
Can you just share for those who are listening in a little bit about who you are before we start talking about your book and some other things?
Sure. Yeah. So my name's Russ Ramsey. I'm a pastor in Nashville, Tennessee. I pastor my congregation is called Christ Presbyterian Church, Cool Springs. I have been a pastor for about 20 years almost, and preaching weekly and leading a congregation. It's my first love vocationally. I've been a student of art for a long time, and not in a formal sense. I didn't take, like, I wasn't an art major in college. But I've been paying attention to art since I was in middle school, and it's just part of the fabric of my interests, and it's a way for me to understand the world. And so I've spent a lot of time thinking about how does art and beauty intersect with faith and things like doubt and struggle and suffering and hope and joy. Beauty, wonder. And so those are kind of the areas that I swim in. I'm a writer, I'm a hiker, I'm a preacher, I'm a father and a husband, and here in a very creative city in Middle Tennessee.
Yes, I love the area where you are. Absolutely, yeah. Beautiful. And I know spring has come to that region as well as it's getting there.
It is. It flirts with us. It comes and then it goes, and then it comes back, and then it goes, and who knows?
I want to tell you a little bit about the context and how God brought me to discover you. And I want to make a statement, and then we're going to roll back to the statement in just a moment. But in my life, art is often the surprise I did not expect. Of all the possibilities, film and writing, and it's art where God seems to surprise me, take me off guard, catch me just out of the blue. And I'll give you a few examples of that. Several years ago, I was leading an event out in Texas. And at the end of that week, I had planned to go to Fort Worth. Lo and behold, somebody told me that week, you know, there's a Monet exhibit at the Kimball Art Museum. And it was Monet, the early years. So had an opportunity to take part of that. I had a grandson who was born back about 2 years ago, 3 years ago now. And as I drove through Fort Worth again on my way to West Texas, lo and behold, Kimball Art Museum, Monet, the late years. I caught the early and late. I don't think they offered the middle years. And then last year, in the end of last year, I'd gone out to Arches National Park. So you talked about being a hiker. I love to hike and be outdoors. And I finally made it to Arches. I was flying back into Dallas-Fort Worth, and I was planning on getting in my car and driving on to Alabama, where I live. My son and his family, and now my daughter and her family, live there. And I just decided I'm going to spend one more night with them, drive it the next day, which was Saturday. And as I'm driving up to his house, I see on the interstate Van Gogh and the olive groves. And I was like, what? And so it just happened to be there at the Dallas Art Museum. So I caught that, went back and caught it about 3 months later when I was visiting again, just so I could slow down and enjoy the art. And just like surprise after surprise after surprise. And how I discovered Rembrandt is in the wind. I had read one of your other books, The Passion of the King of Glory, a few years back in this time during Lent. And I happened to catch, it was like 24-hour notice, the Rabbit Room said you were coming on board on Tuesday night to introduce your book. And so I was like, yeah, I want to go to be a part of that, because I caught you twice during Hutchmute Homebound. Yeah. First, okay. You were talking about Caravaggio, and I just listened. I was just deeply moved by that. Then the next year, you talked about Edward and Joe Norton. And so I was like, every time I've heard you speak, it's just been like a wow moment. And so anyway, heard about your book, bought your book. And wow, it's one of my favorite books from last year. And I talk about me being surprised by art. Have you ever been surprised by art?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I started paying attention to art a lot when I was in high school. I discovered Van Gogh. And one of the ways art works is if you pay attention to it over time, an artist will introduce you to their friends and mentors. You know, if you go see Van Gogh, he'll introduce you to the Impressionists and the Post-Impressionists. And they'll introduce you to the people that they revered, like Rembrandt and Caravaggio and Vermeer. So I have this this kind of body of work that rolls around in my head all the time, of just paintings that I've seen and been drawn to. And this past summer, I took one of my daughters to London as a kind of a graduation trip, and we went to the National Gallery there, just in Trafalgar Square, right in the middle of London. And I knew that there's going to be lots of beautiful, like there's going to be lots of Van Gogh and Rembrandt here. Those are my two that I go. If I go to an art museum, I make sure I see them. Yeah. And then if there's time for other things, I will see them. There's always time for other things. But anyway, what I didn't do, and I don't tend to do, is look ahead to see what's in the museum, because I like to be surprised by what they have. And so I was standing in a hallway, and at the end of the hallway, I saw a Rembrandt self-portrait. And so I kind of grabbed my daughter by the sleeve and led her down the hall to stand in front of this Rembrandt self-portrait that I'd seen before in pictures. And so we're standing in front of it, and I'm looking at it, and I turn, over my left shoulder to look at her, to tell her something about the portrait. And behind her is Rembrandt's Adoration of the Shepherds, which is one of his nativity paintings that is one of my all-time favorite Rembrandt paintings ever. I had no idea that it was there. And my daughter being 21, pulled out her phone immediately and started videoing my reaction to being in the same room as this painting that I've seen my whole life and been mesmerized by, and had no idea that I was 30 feet away from it. And she has this video of me like a moth to a flame. I just can't talk, and wandering over and standing in front of it with just, like a little kid, meeting a hero. That's an example. That kind of thing happens where art, I feel like it'll sometimes catch me by surprise, put its hands on my shoulders and pull me close. Almost like a tractor beam in a Star Wars movie, like I can't resist. And that's part of the beauty of it. And that day in that museum, I'll never forget it. And I have a video.
That's awesome. That's awesome. It's amazing to me. You can discover a work of art in a book, but there's nothing like seeing it in person. Mm-hmm. that you see the brush strokes, you see all the little details. It's just, what is that like for you?
Yeah, you see, I think one of the things that you see is the difference between seeing a painting online or in print versus in person is when you see it in print or online, you see the image. But when you see it in person, you see the artist. Like you see the way that their hands moved. You see the layering of paint. You see places where you can make out the canvas underneath the paint because it's not filled in, or you know that there are things where you can see sort of the method of the person who put the painting together, and that gives it a whole nother dimension of life and a whole other dimension of significance and meaning. And then you read whatever the little tombstone on the wall next to it says, and it takes you even deeper into not just the composition of the painting itself, but to what was happening and who this person was and what was going on at the time. And it's very relational because art is a form of communication. It's not just here's a pretty picture to look at. It's the person who made the painting is saying something, and they're trying to say something to the person who's looking at it, right? That's the whole point. It's a transaction. It's a conversation. It's a question. It's a statement. It's any manner of things, depending on what the composition is that you're looking at. But it's hard to get it's easier to be drawn into the conversation when you're looking at the original, because it's like being in the same room with the artist as opposed to just reading their mail.
Yeah. I think you carry that out in the writing, in the chapters of your book, Rembrandt is in the Wind. You have the gift of empathy. And what I mean by that, you're not only empathetic with the artist, but you're also empathetic with the art as well. And I give you a couple examples. As I was reading the book, I read this one chapter at a time, one chapter a day, because I savored this. When I read the chapter on Michelangelo's David and learned of that his ankles, this great statue, are disintegrating. And then when I read about the theft of the storm of the Sea of Galilee, Rembrandt's work, both those chapters, and as well as many others, I ached. As I read that, I was just like, first, I wanted to jump on a plane, go to Florence and see David's statue. My daughter has seen it, but I have not. And then, you know, I was like, let's find this painting. How did such, I think you just kind of gave us a clue what you just said about actually seeing an art piece, but how did such empathy develop in you? I mean, because you do it very, very well.
Well, thank you. I think I'm a storyteller at heart. I come from a people of storytellers. As a pastor, I'm a storyteller, and human beings are, we are collectors of stories. It was the primary method of Jesus' teaching, right? He told parables. There was a man who had two sons. So whenever I see a work of art that has transcended time, something that has stood for hundreds of years and has been placed in a museum, and people give up money and vacation days to go to the other side of the planet to stand in front of it, there's something going on with it that makes me curious about the story. Who's the person who made this? Why is this so prominent? What about this particular work of art draws people with such force? Like more than a million pilgrims a year go to see Michelangelo's David. And have been for 500 years. That ought to raise a question in our minds to say, what's going on? why that? And Rembrandt's Storm on the Sea of Galilee, the fact that he painted himself into that painting made me want to understand Rembrandt's life and to study it. And then when you study it, and you look at the lives of these artists, they're all sad stories. They're all tragic stories. They're all stories filled with suffering and triumph and a gifting, and then also a world that's, it sounds cliche, but a world that's not quite ready for them. And so you get to know kind of the struggle of these artists trying to say something beautiful and substantive and transformational to a world that's struggling to understand. And yet the testimony of the paintings being in museums and the statues being in rotundas that belong just to them is kind of the world answering back and saying, we understand, or at least we're trying to understand. Mm-hmm. The problem is us, not you, you know? And so there's that intersection of the person who made the work itself, its transcendence, its history, what it's trying to say, how people react to it, the story of the life of the person who made it, and at what point in their life did they make this? Though all of those things, when they come together for me, it's always a fascinating, beautiful story, always.
You have if I recall correctly, you have a work of art there in your church. Caravaggio's one of his paintings, is that mm-hmm, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah, we have the Incredulity of Saint Thomas, which is the one where Jesus is guiding Thomas's finger into the wound in his side, the risen Christ, and it's in the back of our sanctuary, and we have a church with a lot of little children. And it's kind of a grotesque painting in the sense that there's an open wound and there's no blood, but there's an open wound and there's a finger inside the wound. And one of the reasons I have that painting in our sanctuary, in our church, is because I first saw that painting when I was a child. And I remember having this sense of, I don't know if I'm supposed to be looking at this, because it's kind of grotesque. It's am I too young to be seeing this? But also I wanted to know, what am I looking at? What's happening in this painting? And so we have lots of children in our church that see this painting every week as part of the collection that hangs in our church. And it's by design, because I want them to wonder. I want them to ask their parents. I want them to try to understand. If they can read, I want them to read the little plaque on the wall next to it. That talks about the intersection of faith and doubt and the reality of the resurrection of Jesus and the improbability of the resurrection of Jesus as well. You know, that Thomas was not without a case to say, you can't just tell me that somebody is risen from the dead, because people don't raise from the dead. Like he was justified, and yet he was wrong. And that is a story that I love not only our children but our adults to have to wrestle through and think through as people on a journey of faith.
Yeah. Was there a single moment that you recall where art overwhelmed you, a particular art piece? And I'll give you an example, not from art but from another art form, movies. And I have always loved Westerns. I remember the Western that developed the love of Westerns. It was a John Wayne movie, The Sons of Katie Elder. And just seeing, at the time, you were watching it in a square as opposed to how it's set and meant to be seen in letterbox. But just the beauty of the soundtrack and the scenery and the story itself, which is a redemption story. And I was hooked from that moment on, and not just with him, but just all Westerns. Do you have a moment like that where art was like, bam, one piece drew you in?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I have a few, but one would be, I spent a semester in college living in Israel, and I lived in Jerusalem for about 4 months, and they have an art museum there in Jerusalem where there are, there were some Van Gogh paintings. Mm. And I would go when I was homesick, I would go visit Vincent. He was kind of what tethered me to home. And I would go to the museum and I would sit in the room, where the Van Goghs were, on a little bench in front of the painting, and just be there for 20 or 30 minutes with a journal, just kind of writing. it's funny how art has a way of sort of anchoring you to, you know, to home and to where you come from and to the stories that have sort of been woven into the fabric of how you think and what you believe. And Vincent has always been to me since high school, somebody that I felt like I knew or at least understood. Now I regard him as a friend that I've never met. Yeah. And it's funny, even in the book, I'll refer to, you know, Vermeer and, you know, Hopper and, you know, all these other painters by their last names. And Vincent, I call Vincent, because he and I are tight, you know? And so whenever I walk into a room where there's a Van Gogh, I feel like I'm walking into a room where there's a friend in the room at this stage of my life, and which is different than walking into a room where there's a Monet or a Dali or something like that, where I'll see them and I'll know what they are. And I'll even want to go up and see them and take them in and enjoy them and maybe even walk away feeling like, wow, that is now a painting that I can't stop thinking about. Yeah. But with Vincent, it's a different journey for me.
I identify with that. He is my favorite artist by far. And to be able to see that collection there in Dallas that he painted, you know, there within the, you know, final years of his life, it was just.
That sounds like a really amazing exhibition. Like I'd never even heard of that one.
The only place it's been shown, maybe except back in Amsterdam, I think they were doing it there, but was in Dallas. It was curated specifically there for Dallas. Wow. And I've kind of got my radar out now. This fall, winter, there was Van Gogh in America up in Detroit. And what I wanted to do, I heard somebody say, and it may have been Andrew Peterson, I don't know. Somebody said, y'all were at a conference together, you had some time off, and you rolled up on him and said, hey, you know, let's go check out this art museum. And in my mind, I sometimes have a Walter Mitty mind, you know, just like, I'd call Russ Ramsey up and say, hey, let's go to Detroit for the day and check that out.
I've heard amazing things about the Detroit Art Institute, just amazing things. Never been, but I've heard that the collection that they have there is just surprising. So I got to get out there sometime.
Yeah. If you ever want company, you have plenty of company, I'm sure, but I'd love to check that out. I want to, based because you talked about Vincent, there is a song written by Don McLean back on the American Pie album. Yes. And my favorite Don McLean song is not American Pie. It's Starry, Starry Night. You're familiar with that song. How do the words of that song resonate with you?
Well, his, you know, the world was never meant for one as beautiful as you. That line in that song is what's so fascinating to me about the story of Van Gogh. There's a few things in play. One is he wrote so many letters, and it was only 130 years ago that he died. So he wrote so many letters to his brother and others that have been preserved, that we have this written record in his own hand about his artistic life, where he only painted for 9 years. And in the letters that he wrote, he would often draw, sketch out paintings he was working on and mention them. And so we know when he painted the paintings. Like most all of his paintings, we can actually date within the week of when he painted them because of the correspondence that he had. And so what you end up with is this flurry of paintings that he produced, 860 paintings in the course of 9 years, which is a crazy amount of work, especially when you consider that the vast majority of it, probably two-thirds or better, was done in the last 4 years of his life. He was averaging the last 3 years of his life, he was averaging one painting every 3 days. The last 3 months of his life before he shot himself, he was averaging a painting a day. And it's not like, you know, little sketches. These are paintings that are hanging in the museums that we go to see. Mm-hmm. Like these are the, you know, the paintings from 1890. When you see a painting that says 1890, he was doing a painting a day at that point. And what happened, he died in 1890, and before the end of that century, he became a superstar. He became a one of the most celebrated artists in Europe. By the time we got into the 1920s and 30s, Irving Stone was writing historical novels about Vincent's life using the letters. Fast forward another 20 or 30 years, you've got Kirk Douglas playing him in Technicolor. Had Vincent lived, he would have lived to see a lot of that. And so when I hear the Don McLean song, part of the ache in the song is how Vincent never experienced the world's response to what it is that he did, to what it is that he gave us. There's that famous Doctor Who clip. If you're listening to this and if you type into a search engine Doctor Who Van Gogh, you're going to find a clip that you should watch. And it's a clip of time travelers bringing Vincent Van Gogh to a museum to see his work on display and to see people see his work on display. And it's very moving.
Wow.
But when I hear when I hear that, I actually have a playlist on my iTunes of songs about Vincent Van Gogh. And it's not a super long playlist, but that song is the flagship of the fleet, as they say. And it's just a heartbreaking song about the striving man in Ecclesiastes, who is toiling away under the sun and not seeing the fruit of his labor and doesn't get to in this life. And it's just a heartbreaking story, and yet one that's probably more common to man than the alternative.
Yeah. I'll put that link to the Doctor Who Van Gogh in the notes for this, so the folks can easily find it. Now the line, how it ends, they would not listen. They're not listening still. Perhaps they never will. And that is like, oh, wow, what am I not listening to? What am I not seeing? Just kind of being wide open to wonder and everything and just not missing something that God intends me to catch or to see. I remember, and I think I recall correctly, that first night in the Rabbit Room, you talked about the book and you mentioned the first chapter. You had to go back and write a chapter. Maybe this is not exactly how you said it, but you kind of indicated that you did not like that addition of that chapter because you did not feel it fit the flow of the book. Do you still feel that way after? Because I loved the first chapter, and it was just the beauty and brokenness how you introduced that.
I realized that because the book is a collection of stories, each chapter is a long form storytelling. But the first chapter sets the table for all of that. Mm-hmm. So the first chapter is a little bit more looking the reader in the eye and saying, here's why it's important for us to think about beauty. And I did weave Van Gogh into it, his self-portrait with bandaged ear so it was kind of a little bit through gritted teeth because I just wanted to tell stories, but I thought I need to help set the context for this book. So that readers will know what it is, what it's not, but also give kind of a primer for why it's even important to engage with stories like this and to think about beauty. So it is an outlier, like in the sense that it's, the next chapter is the Michelangelo's David, and then after that you've got, Caravaggio and Vermeer and Rembrandt and so on. And they're all standalone stories. But, as I've had time to kind of reflect on it, and hear people interact with it, people have seemed to really appreciate the way that sort of sets the table for the rest of what's to come and gives a little bit of a context for how to engage with that. Yeah. And it's funny when I hear people tell me that they really, really like chapter one, because it was for me the hardest chapter to write. Even though it starts the book, but it reminds me of I went to the Metropolitan Museum of or no, I went to the Museum of Modern Art, MoMA, in New York City, where Vincent's Starry Night hangs. And I was there on a Tuesday morning or something, and it wasn't super crowded. There were people around, but it wasn't super crowded. And I was by myself, and I knew that Vincent hated that painting. He did not like it. And the reason he didn't like it is because he knew that he was trying to imitate a style that was popular. And so he was an indie artist trying to write a pop song is what mm-hmm. he was. And it bothered his conscience. And when we think about Van Gogh, we think, oh, he did the swirling skies. Actually, he only did that once. He has some clouds that swirl, but Starry Night is kind of a standalone. He has other night scenes, but the skies are always very, very different. And so I'm standing there next to the docent in the room, and I just mentioned to him, you know, Vincent hated that painting. And the docent said to me, that just kind of goes to demonstrate that an artist is not always the best judge of their own work.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, you just took me to school. Okay. So yeah. Take that for what it's worth.
You know, often when I preach a sermon or just finish writing something, I have to put it away because often I don't like it. I'm like, oh, that was terrible. But I come back and listen 6 months, give myself some distance from it to let it breathe. And I'm like, oh, okay. Yeah, I can. Yeah. Thank you, God. You're the one that gave it. So in that first chapter, here's a quote on beauty and brokenness. You say, how can we tell the story of our healing if we hide the wounds that need it? This story is about beauty. To get at it, this book is filled with stories of brokenness. And I want you to take just a moment and put on your, I mean, I don't think you've ever taken it off. No, none of us ever do, our theologian's cap or your pastor's cap. But make the connection between brokenness, beauty, and redemption in everyday terms.
Yeah. So everybody has things in their lives that are broken, things we wish weren't the case about us, aches that we have, longings for things to be healed, changed, some of which we may not ever experience in this world. You know, we may go through our whole lives with, you know, the Apostle Paul referred to it as a thorn in his side, thorn in his flesh. But even some temptations that we have, the temptations we carry around that, you know, we may think, why don't I have victory over this? Why is this still a temptation in my life? It may be for the rest of your days, you know. And what that is telling us is the hope of salvation cannot rest in you and I figuring it out. It can't rest in you and I being able to identify all the areas of sin and brokenness in our life and then eradicate them from our lives on our own. There has to be redemption. We have to be redeemed. We have to be rescued from our brokenness and our sin. And the beauty that is found in brokenness is when that brokenness is healed, is when that brokenness is redeemed by something so precious that you discover that the brokenness wasn't actually something that devalued us, but was something that was incapable of overcoming how valuable we actually are to the Lord. And so in my office, I'm touching it right now with my hand, a reproduction of Van Gogh's self-portrait with bandaged ear. And I hang it in my office. I have another copy of it in my office at home as a way of reminding myself of the kind of pastor that I want to be. He painted this painting. If people know Van Gogh, they generally know two things. They know that he painted Starry Night, and they know that he cut off his ear. And those are the two things that they're the starter kit for learning about Vincent Van Gogh. And when he cut off his ear, it was the lowest moment in his entire life. It was a shameful thing. It was a manic thing. There was mental illness involved. There was a community that thought he was a madman, and he painted it in an asylum where he was recovering. And when you do a self-portrait, you have the freedom to paint whatever you want. You can put whatever shirt on you want. You can have the hair do whatever you want. And he chose to show the wound. He chose to show the bandaged side, capturing this lowest moment in his life, and put it on canvas and capture it. And now it's a painting that's worth millions and millions and millions of dollars. It's of an inestimable worth because it captures this beautiful soul in this moment of deep brokenness in such a beautiful way. And I think as a pastor, I want to be willing to let people see my woundedness, mm-hmm. to not just paint the ear whole, but to let the wounded side show. Because how can I call people into a relationship with Jesus who heals and redeems and restores if part of the way I call them into that is it conveys to them that it's something they may need, even though I don't? That as a pastor, I'm not 101 level anymore. The truth is I'm in second grade when it comes to a lot of understanding the gospel and redemption. I'm new at this, and we all will be. But the beauty of that painting is that it is at the same time capturing the brokenness and so valuable, and because of the honesty of it. So Henry Nouwen said, our brokenness has no other beauty but the beauty that comes from the compassion that surrounds it. And that's the heart of redemption, is in our brokenness, there is the embrace of the Father who welcomes the prodigal in and pleads with the self-righteous son to also join the party. And so that's an ongoing reality for me as a pastor is that I'm wrestling with my own brokenness, and I'm also wrestling with the brokenness of others who come to me because of the role that I occupy in my community.
Yeah, that's well spoken. Beauty, brokenness, redemption, those three terms that just resonate within me. And I could unpack that as far as, you know I'm broken. I have a saying, broken is who we are. It's not all we are. And I think that we all have to have that moment where we recognize, I'm broken. We often say, I live in a broken world, but we're part of it, and I'm part of it, and I'm deeply flawed. Thank you for that. Just a few quick questions, and then we'll roll out here. Do you have a favorite chapter in the book?
Yeah. My favorite chapter is the Van Gogh chapter.
Okay.
About the striving artist, about the only painting that he ever sold when he was alive. That's probably my favorite.
Okay. Is there a Rembrandt is in the Wind sequel in the works? Obviously not titled that. There is.
Yes, there is. Yeah. I'm actually working on that manuscript now. I've got about 8 of the chapters. There'll be 10, another 10 stories. About 8 of the chapters are underway. And the manuscript is due this summer. It'll be coming out in 2024.
Okay.
So I'm thrilled about that.
Okay. I'm thrilled about it. I look forward to that. I'll be one of your pre-orders. Can't wait to hear what you title it, because I have favorite book titles. One of my favorite titles is, I think it was written by Jill Briscoe, Here Am I, Send Aaron. and this one, Rembrandt is in the Wind. Yeah, it just says so much. That's good. You do also do a thing called on social media, and I know you do it on Instagram because that's where I follow you. Mm-hmm. You may do it on other platforms as well, called Art Wednesday. Just briefly tell the listeners about Art Wednesday.
Yeah. So every Wednesday on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, I post a series of about 7 to 9 works of art over the course of a day. And they're all related somehow. They're either by the same artist or they have some theme that ties them together. Like these are paintings that have been stolen and never recovered. As of when we're recording this, the previous Art Wednesday was all about Marc Chagall. I did this as a way of doing kind of two things. One, it was to inject some beauty into the social media stream. It feels like it can use it a lot of times, that it can be a difficult place. And what I wanted to do was just sort of insert beauty. It's also been a primary way that I study art. Is by creating these series that I release every Wednesday. It makes me have to go and learn, I've been doing it for this is my fourth year, of doing Art Wednesdays. And it's really, really fun and challenging. And it's just opened my eyes to a whole new world, to so many new worlds of painters and stories about art. So if you follow me, every Wednesday, it'll be Art Wednesday, and I'll just be posting over the course from about 7:30 in the morning until about 5 in the afternoon. They'll come out just, you know, one at a time, mm-hmm. with a little blurb that sort of describes it. And by the time you're done, it's a little kind of a short essay on whatever the theme is for the day. So it's one of my favorite things to do. Love it.
I'm grateful you're putting that out there. Have a quick question about, have you considered maybe these artists in future Art Wednesdays, the work of Howard Finster? You familiar with him? He's the...
I'm not familiar with him. I'm going to write him down.
Yeah, the folk artist from Northern Georgia. I think he is no longer here or with us. And he's just a very unique style of folk artist. Mm-hmm. He's also an artist, but it's just kind of a different form. Charles Schulz. I was in California a couple of years ago, a couple of months back, and I happened to catch his museum. And I've always loved peanuts, and mm-hmm. just to be able to, I was actually seeing his actual writing. It was just a different artist, a different form, mm-hmm. but so rich in what he brought to the cartoon. I'm just curious, just seeing if either two of those were on your radar. So,
you know, I haven't really done cartoonists before. I've done illustrators.
Mm-hmm. Norman Rockwell.
But I've not. I did Rockwell and Edward Hopper started off as an illustrator. I haven't done graphic novels or that. I haven't kind of delved into that. I've kind of stayed more in the art museum kind of lane, but who knows.
Yeah, just a that's thought.
It's part of the journey of discovery for me.
Yeah, isn't it wonderful to discover new really things? Learning, always learning, man. I am grateful for the time. Enjoyed this, and I know our listeners have as well. We're going to let you go. And thank you for coming to Redemption's Table. And just, I encourage everybody listening, go get Rembrandt Is in the Wind. For me, it was the best art book I've ever read. So I cannot recommend this book enough. And also through the Rabbit Room, if you're familiar with the Rabbit Room, they just released a special edition of the book. So thanks, Russ, for being with us today. And
my pleasure.
Yeah, looking forward to the next thing you've got coming out. So God bless you, my friend.
Thank you.
I'd like to be remembered and leave a lasting legacy. After all